Welcome to Love's Tender Flame. Tales of Romance. I'm Mardell. Reading Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller. Chapter 6. On the stroke of 7 o'clock the next morning, Burton came downstairs with that exactness which even the most careless man can display in regard to his favorite sport. The rigors of the cub-hunting season being over, the meet did not take place until 8. Cora was not yet ready for breakfast, and Crane went to fill his cigarette case before starting. The drawing-room was still dark and in disorder. Crane lit a match to find his way to the table where the tobacco was kept. It was the same table on which had lain the miniature of the lady in the mauve ball dress. And as he held up his lighted match, his eyes sought once more that enchanting pearl circle. The flame died down and burned his fingers before his eyes had encountered what they were looking for. He lit a second match, and then a candle, before he could assure himself that the miniature was really gone. He sprang into the hall and called, "Smithfield!" with a violence that had little respect for late sleepers. Smithfield came hurrying out of the dining room. "Where's the miniature that used to be on this table?"
What is it, sir?"
"The miniature, a picture in a pearl frame." Smithfield looked thoughtful.
"And what was it a picture of, sir?"
"Of a lady."
"In a black lace cap, and she with white hair, sir?"
"No," said Crane. "She was young and lovely in a ball dress and a wreath. You must remember it. It was here yesterday." Smithfield shook his head blankly.
"No, sir," he said. "I can't rightly say that I remember it, but I'll inquire for it."
Crane swore with an uncontrollable irritation. Irritation at Smithfield for being so stupid. Irritation that he himself had been so careless as to leave the picture about among a houseful of unknown servants. He was not distracted, even by the sight of Cora coming downstairs, looking very workmanlike in her habit, with her hat well down over her brows, and her boots, over which Brindlebury had evidently expended himself, showing off her slender feet. They breakfasted alone, but Burton's mind ran on the loss of the miniature, and he did not really recover his temper until he had mounted Cora, found all the straps of her skirt, adjusted her stirrup, loosened the curb for her, and finally swung himself up on his own hunter, a big, ugly chestnut. The meet was nearby, and they were going to jog quietly over to it. They took a short cut across the lawn, and at the sight of the turf, at the smell of the fresh, clear morning, the horses began to dance as spontaneously as children will at the sound of a street organ. Crane and Cora glanced at each other and laughed at this exhibition of high spirits on the part of their darlings. No horseman is proof against the pleasure of seeing one of his treasured animals well shown by its rider, and the Irish mare had never looked as well as she now did under Cora's skillful management. He told her so, praising her hands, her appearance, her understanding of the horse's mind, and she very fittingly replied with flattery of the mare and of Crane's own remarkable powers of selection. They were getting on so well that Burton found himself saying earnestly, "You really must stay on as long as I do, Cora. Don't let your mother take you away as she wants to." The girl's surprise actually checked the mare in her stride. "My mother is thinking of going away?" she cried. Well, of course, he wanted her to stay, wanted her even to want to stay, but somehow he did not want her to be so much terrified at the thought of departure, did not want her black eyes to open upon him with such manifest horror at the bare idea of departure. He suggested sending the horses along a little,
and they cantered side by side on the grass at the roadside. Crane kept casting the glances of a lover, not at Cora, but at the black mare, as she arched her neck to a light touch on the curb, so that the sunlight ran in iridescent colors along her crest. Presently they saw two horsemen ahead of them, one of them in that weather-stained pink that to hunting eyes makes the most beautiful piece of color imaginable against the autumn fields. "That's Elliot, the master," cried Crane. "The hounds must be just ahead. He's a nice old fellow. Let's join him. I can't make out who the other one is. No one who was out the last time we hunted." The canter had given Cora a color. She looked straight before her for a moment, and then she said, "I think I recognize that other man."
"Who is it?"
"Someone I should like you to know, Bert. His name is Lefferts." The lane was now too narrow for four to ride abreast. Crane drew Elliot to his side. He wanted to ask him about the Croslet Billingtons, for since the disappearance of the miniature, he had made up his mind to investigate the references of his staff. But, strange to say, Elliot had never heard of the Billingtons, of their collection of tapestry, or their villa at Capri. He wished to talk of the Reveilles.
"A great loss they are to the country, Crane, though of course we gain you. I wonder where they are. Gone north, I heard, though I thought I saw one of the boys out this morning of the day you came. The Reveilles will hunt anything, from a plow horse to a thoroughbred. Hard up, you know. Glad they consented to rent their house. Didn't suppose they ever would. Too proud, you know. They have things in it of immense value. Portrait of the grandfather, Marshal Reveille, second in command to Stonewall Jackson at one time. I'd like to have you know them. Paul, the elder brother, is a man of some ability and may make his mark. And the younger daughter, Miss Claudia Reveille."
Do what he would, Elliot's voice changed slightly in pronouncing the name. "Miss Claudia is one of our great beauties, the recipient of a great deal of attention.
Why, sir, last summer when Daniel W. Williams, the governor-elect of this state, saw Miss Claudia, it..."
But the story, in which, to be candid, Crane did not take a great deal of interest, was interrupted by Cora, who pushed her mare forward in order to attract Crane's attention and to introduce him to her companion. The young man was extraordinarily good-looking. His eyes were a strange greenish-brown color, like the water in the dock of a city ferry. His skin was ivory in hue and smooth as a woman's, but his hands and a certain decisiveness of gesture were virile in the extreme.
"We ought to have a good run," said Crane,
in order to say something.
"If any run can be good," answered the young man.
"You don't like hunting?"
"I hate anything to do with horses," answered Lefferts plaintively. "You must admit, they are particularly unintelligent animals. If they weren't, of course, they wouldn't let us bully them and ride them about when they could do anything they wanted with us. No, I only do it because she," he nodded toward Miss Falconer, "makes me."
Cora, looking very handsome, laughed.
"He's a poet," she said.
"Is that why he has to hunt?"
asked Crane, and he wondered if poetry had anything to do with the excellence of the young man's coat and boots.
"Yes, poets have to be athletic nowadays. It's the fashion, and a very good one, too.
There are other forms of athletics I don't hate nearly as much," Lefferts went on to Crane. "Swimming, for instance, and sailing. And even walking isn't so bad. It doesn't need so much preparation and getting up early in the morning, all that sort of thing."
"Fortunately, I know what's best for him," said Cora.
"She makes me think she does," said the poet, still plaintively.
Crane wanted to ask Cora where and how she had acquired this rather agreeable responsibility, but he had no opportunity,
before they were off. He and Cora started together, less perhaps from chivalry on Burton's part than because of his desire to watch the performance of the mare, but in the course of the run they became separated, and he finally jogged home alone. He dismounted in the stable yard and stood watching one of the grooms loosening the saddle girths while he and the head man discussed the excellent conduct of his own horses as compared with the really pitiable showing of other people's, and debated whether the wretched deterioration in a certain Canadian bay horse ridden that day by the master of hounds was owing to naturally poor conformation on the part of the horse, or deplorable lack of judgment on the part of the rider. In the midst of these absorbing topics, Crane suddenly became aware that Smithfield was waiting for him at the gateway. He stopped short in what he was saying. "You wanted to speak to me, Smithfield?"
"When you finished, sir."
Crane had finished, he said, and turned in the direction of the house, with the butler at his side.
"There's been a terrible disturbance at the house, sir, since you went out this morning."
"Oh, my powers!" cried Burton. "What has been happening now?" Smithfield was stepping along, throwing out his feet, and resting on the ball of his foot with the walk that Mrs. Falconer had so much admired.
"Well, sir," he said, "the trouble has been between Mr. Tucker and Brindlebury."
Crane groaned.
"I don't defend the boy, sir. I fear he forgot his place."
"Look here, Smithfield," said Crane, "candidly now, what is the matter with all of you? You know, you really are a very queer lot."
Thus appealed to, Smithfield considered. "Well, sir," he said, "I think the trouble, as much as any one thing is the trouble, is that we're young, and servants oughtn't to be young. They should be strong, healthy, hard-working, but not young, for youth means impulses, hopes of improvement, love of enjoyment, all qualities servants must not have."
The man spoke entirely without bitterness, and Crane, turning to him, said suddenly, "Smithfield, what do you think about class distinctions?" For the first time, Smithfield smiled.
"I think, sir," he said, "that if they were done away with, I should lose my job."
"Well, by heaven, if I were you then," cried Crane with unusual feeling, "I'd get a job that wasn't dependent on a lie. For if I believe anything, it is that all these dissimilarities between rich and poor and men and women and black and white are pretty trivial as compared with their similarities. It's my opinion we are all very much alike, Smithfield." And Crane, as he spoke, was astonished at the passion for democracy that stirred within him.
"That, sir," replied Smithfield, "if you forgive my saying it, is the attitude toward democracy of someone who has always been at the top. There must be distinctions, mustn't there, sir? And you would probably say that the ideal distinction was along the line of merit, that everyone should have the place in the world that he deserves. But dear me, sir, that would be very cruel. So many of us would then be face to face with our own inferiority. Now, as things are, I can think that it's only outside conditions that are keeping me down, and that I should make as good or even better a master, I begging your pardon, than you, sir. But under a true democracy, if I were still in an inferior position, I should have to admit I belong there, which I don't admit at all now. Not at all."
"But how about my not admitting that I'm a master?" said Crane.
"In one sense, perhaps, you are not, sir," answered Smithfield, "for after all, some training is necessary to be a servant. particularly a butler, but for the exercise of the functions of the higher classes. No training at all seems to be required. Curious, isn't it, sir? Utterly unskilled labor is found only among the very rich and the very poor. The conversation had brought them to the house. Without the case of Brindlebury having been further discussed, suddenly realizing this, Crane stopped at the foot of the steps. "Now what is it that's happened?" he asked. Smithfield showed some embarrassment. "I'm afraid, sir," he said, "that some rather hot words passed. In fact, I do so much regret it, sir, but I fear Brindlebury actually raised his hand against Mr. Tucker." It was a triumph of self-control that not a muscle of Burton's face quivered at this intelligence. "If that is true," he said, "the boy will have to go, of course." "I had hoped you might wish to hear both sides, sir." "No," answered Crane, "I might hear what Brindlebury had to say, or I might understand without hearing, or I might know that I should have done the same thing in his place, or even going a step farther. I might think him right to have done it, but the fact remains that I can't keep a servant who strikes a guest of mine. That's a class distinction, Smithfield, but there it is." Smithfield bowed. "If I might suggest, sir, that perhaps you do not understand rightly how Mr. Tucker—" "Nothing like that, Smithfield. Tell the boy to go. Go this afternoon. Pay him what's right and get him out." He ran up the steps, but turned halfway and added with a smile, "And you know, there really isn't anything you could tell me about Mr. Tucker that I haven't known a great deal longer than any of you have." He went in. Tucker and Mrs. Falconer were sitting side by side in the drawing room, with that unmistakable air of people who expect, and have a right to expect, that they should be given an opportunity to tell their troubles. The only revenge that Crane permitted himself, if indeed revenge can be used to describe so mild a punishment, was that he continued to ignore their perfectly obvious grumpiness. "Well," he said, "you look cozy. Hope you've had as good a day as we have." Tucker opened his mouth to say, "We have not," but Crane was already in full description of the run, undaunted by the fact that neither of his listeners, if they were indeed listeners, could be induced to manifest enough interest in his story to meet his eye. "I'm glad someone has enjoyed the day," said Tucker, as Crane paused to light a cigarette. He laid an unmistakable emphasis on the words, "someone." Crane patted him on the shoulder. "Thanks, Tuck," he said. "I believe that's true. I believe you are glad. Yes, we had a good day. 3 foxes, and your daughter, Mrs. Falconer, went like a bird. She's a wonderful horsewoman, not only looks well herself, but makes the horse look well, too." At this, Mrs. Falconer's manner grew distinctly more cheerful, and she asked, "And by the way, where is Cora?" Tucker, annoyed at the desertion on the part of his alley, pressed his hand over his eyes and sighed audibly, but no one noticed him. "I took a wrong turn in search of a short cut and lost the rest of them," said Crane. "But she'll be back directly. She's perfectly safe. She was with Elliot, our neighbor, and a fellow named Lefferts, whom she seemed to know." "Lefferts!" cried Mrs. Falconer. "That man here? Oh, Burton, how could you leave my daughter in such company? Oh, Solon, you remember I told you about that man?" Tucker nodded shortly. He wasn't going to take any interest in anyone's grievances until his own had been disposed of. "What's the matter with Lefferts?" said Crane. "He's staying with Elliot, and they asked us all over to lunch tomorrow. Shan't we go?" "No, nowhere, that young man is," cried Mrs. Falconer,
who seemed to be a good deal excited by the news. "He's an idler, a waster."
"Why, Burton," she ended in a magnificent climax, "he's a poet."
"So Cora told me."
"He affects to be devoted to Cora," her mother went on bitterly, "and follows her about everywhere without the slightest encouragement on her part, I can assure you. But I have known him to take a most insolent tone about her. The very first time I ever saw him, he was sitting beside me at a party. And I said, as Cora came across the room, with that magnificent walk of hers, 'She moves like a full-rigged ship, doesn't she?' He answered, 'Or rather, more like a submarine. You never know where she'll pop up next.' Yes, there's a sort of practical mystery about Cora, very suitable to modern warfare. He called her Cora behind her back, but not to her face, to be sure. And very soon a poem of his appeared in one of the magazines, 'To My Love,' comparing her to a submarine. I thought it most insulting."
"And what did Cora think?"
"Oh, she hardly read the thing through. Cora is far too sensible to pay much attention to poetry."
"But poets are different, I suppose," answered Crane. Personally, he was pleased with the submarine simile.
"No, nor poets either," said Mrs. Falconer tartly,
and rising she hurried away to see if by some fortunate chance her errant daughter had returned without letting her know. Left alone, Crane decided to give his friend his long-desired chance.
"Well, Tuck," he said, "you look in fine form. What have you been doing since I went away?"
"I have not had a very agreeable day," said Tucker in a voice so low and deep it was almost a growl.
"No, not a return of your old dyspepsia, I hope," said Crane. Tucker shook his head impatiently.
"At breakfast," he said, "I heard from Mrs. Falconer, who had heard from her daughter, that you had observed the loss of the miniature that used to lie on this table. Such things cannot be taken lightly, Burton. The owners might have put almost any price on an article of that kind, wretched as it was, as a work of art, and you would be forced to pay. You see, it could not be replaced. I thought it my duty, therefore, to send for each of the servants and question them on the subject."
"You thought it your duty to send for Jane Ellen, Tuck?" Again Tucker frowned.
"I said I sent for all the servants. Smithfield displayed, to my mind, a most suspicious ignorance and indifference to the whole subject. The housemaid was so hysterical and frightened that if I did not know a great deal of such cases, I should suspect her."
"And was the cook frightened?" said Crane with a flicker of a smile.
"No," Tucker explained, "she did not appear to be frightened, but then I may tell you that I do not suspect the cook of complicity in the theft."
"The deuce you don't," said Crane. He found himself suddenly annoyed without reason that Tucker should have been interviewing and questioning his servants during his absence, stirring up trouble, he said to himself, and perhaps hurting the feelings of a perfectly good cook. Suppose she had decided to leave as a result of these activities of Solon's. He found that he had not been listening to the account his friend was giving of the conversation until he heard him say,
"It seems Jane Ellen had never been in this room before. She was very much interested in everything. I saw her looking at that splendid portrait of General Reveille, and she asked, in fact, she made me give her quite a little account of his life."
"A little lecture on the Civil War, eh?" said Crane. His tone was not wholly friendly, and Tucker did not find it so. He colored.
"Really, Burton," he said coldly, "in case of crime or of theft, a man's lawyer is usually supposed to know what is best to do."
"Possibly, but I see no point in having dragged the cook into it."
"I see even less point in treating her on a different plane from any of the other servants."
"It almost seems, Tuck, as if you enjoyed your constant interviews with her. That is just, I regret to say, Burton, what I was thinking about you. It seems to me, said Crane, that this discussion is not leading anywhere and might as well end. One moment, exclaimed the other, my story is not finished. When it came to be the turn of that boy Brindlebury, in whom I may as well tell you I have no confidence whatever, his manner was so insolent, his refusal to answer my questions so suspicious. Well, to make a long story short, your boot boy, Burton, attempted to knock me down, and I had, of course, to put him out of the room. The situation is perfectly simple. I must ask you either to dismiss him or to order the motor to take me to the train. There was a short pause, during which Crane very deliberately lit a cigarette, then he said in a level tone, "The boy is already dismissed. He is out of the house at this moment, probably. As to the other alternative, the ordering the motor, I will, of course, do that too, if you insist." But Tucker did not insist. "On the contrary," he said, "you have done all I could desire, more indeed, for you have evidently decided against the boy before you even heard my side of the case." "One cannot always decide these cases with regard for eternal justice," said Crane. Before Tucker could inquire just what was meant by this rather disagreeable pronouncement, Smithfield appeared in the doorway to say that Jane Ellen would be glad if she might speak to Mr. Crane for a moment. This was what Crane had dreaded. She was going to leave. His anger against Tucker flared up again, but he said, with apparent calmness, that Jane Ellen might come in. Tucker should see for himself the effect of his meddling. Tucker suggested in a sort of half-hearted way that he would go away, but his host told him shortly to remain. Jane Ellen entered. There was no doubt but that she was displeased with the presence of a third party. She made a little bob of a curtsy and started for the door. "I'll come back when you're alone, sir." "No," said Crane, "anything you have to say can be said before Mr. Tucker."
"Oh, of course, sir."
But her tone lacked conviction.
"I wanted to speak about Brindlebury. He is very sorry for what happened, sir. I wish you could see your way."
"I can't," said Crane. Jane Ellen glanced at Tucker under her eyelashes.
"I know, sir," she went on, "that there could be no excuse for the way he has acted, but if any excuse was possible, it did seem..." She hesitated.
"You wish to say," interrupted Burton, who now felt he did not care what he said to anyone, "that Mr. Tucker was extremely provoking, I have no doubt, but that has nothing to do with it."
"Really, Burton," observed his guest, "I don't think that that is the way to speak of me, particularly," he added firmly, "to a servant."
"It is sometimes a good idea to speak the truth, even to servants, Solon," returned Crane. "You are provoking, and no one knows it better than I have known it during the past 15 minutes. But your powers of being provoking have nothing to do with the matter, except theoretically the boy has got to go. I want him to be out of the house within an hour. That is all there is to the whole question, Jane Ellen."
"But, oh, sir, if he is sorry..."
"I doubt very much if he is sorry."
"Oh, why, sir?"
"Because I feel sure that in his place I shouldn't be sorry in the least, except for having failed, if he did fail."
"I know it's a great liberty, sir, but I do wish you could give him another chance."
Her look was extraordinarily appealing.
"What in the world is Brindlebury to you, Jane Ellen?"
"Didn't Mr. Tucker tell you, sir?"
"He's my brother."
"No, he didn't tell me. Did you know he was Jane Ellen's brother, Solon?"
"Brian told him himself, sir."
She was a little overeager. Tucker frowned.
"Yes, I believe the boy did say something to that effect. I own I was not much interested in the fact, and I can't say I think it has any bearing on the present situation."
Crane was silent for an instant. Then he said, "No, it hasn't. He's got to go." And then he added quite clearly and looking at his cook very directly, "But I am sorry, Jane Ellen, not to be able to do anything that you ask me to do." She looked back at him for an instant, with a sort of imperishable sweetness, and then went sadly out of the room. Between Crane and his legal adviser, no further words were exchanged. Crane went and took out one of the motors and rushed at a high rate of speed over the country, frightening one or two sedate black mules, the only other travelers on the roads, and soothing his own irritation by the rapidity of the motion. More and more he regretted not having been able to grant the favor Jane Ellen had so engagingly asked. More and more he felt inclined to believe that in Brindlebury's place he would have done the same thing. More and more did he feel disposed to fasten upon Tucker all the disagreeableness of the situation.
Please join me next time for another romantic chapter of Come Out of the Kitchen by Alice Duer Miller, here on Love's Tender Flame. Until then, love deeply and live beautifully.